to Susan B. Brock, Telluride Inside and Out. I'm honored to be speaking with Tim DeChristopher. Tim is a climate activist, and he is the subject of George and Beth Gage's latest film, Bitter 70. Tim, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So what was it about the Stegner Symposium and your conversation with Tim Root that became turning points in your life? And what were the takeaways from those events and meetings that stick with you today?
Well, it was Terry Root, who was a scientist from Stanford, and one of the lead authors of the IPCC report, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Yeah.
And she'd presented the overview of the IPCC data, and I questioned her about some stuff afterwards. After her presentation, I went up to her and asked her some questions about that data and about some stuff that seemed to indicate that they didn't have any scenario which they saw us avoiding all these worst-case consequences. And she said to me, that's correct. She said we couldn't come up with any scenario in which we averted all the worst-case scenarios that we're talking about with climate change. She said there were things we could have done in the 80s and things we could have done in the 90s, but it's probably too late. And she literally put her hand on my shoulder and said, my generation failed yours. And that was pretty powerful coming from a Nobel Prize winner, you know, telling me that that I didn't really have a future. And it definitely rattled me and did send me into somewhat of a period of despair, but it also really put things in perspective and focused me on a real strong commitment to action. And it what it basically did for me was help me to see that I really had nothing to lose by fighting back. That you know, the worst thing, the scariest thing, would be to do nothing and to stay on the path that we're on now. And that whatever consequences I faced by fighting back would automatically be less than the consequences of not fighting back.
Just to put it in perspective for our listeners, in terms of your very brave act of civil disobedience, what age were you when you met and talked with Terry Root?
I was 26 when I talked with her.
So it was pretty much a year later that you did your action, no?
Yeah, it was less than a year. That was in March of 2008 that I met Terry, and then it was December of 2008 when I disrupted the oil and gas auction.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the transition as well. Could you set that scene? You following an economics exam, you set out to join a protest at the BLM offices. What happened next? What changed things?
Well, on my way down to that protest, you know, I was thinking about all the other protests that I've been to that I felt like I didn't really have an impact. And I decided that this auction was so egregious on so many levels, both with the climate impacts of this drill now, think later mentality and the destruction of our natural lands right outside of Canyonlands and Arches National Parks. And just the lack of a democratic and transparent process and the way that citizens had been locked out. All of that made me see that this was something that demanded stronger action. And since that interaction with Terry Root 9 months earlier, I'd been committing myself slowly to take that level of action and to engage in an appropriate level of resistance. And so I saw that this was as good of an opportunity as any. So I decided that I was actually going to go inside and do whatever I could to cause a disruption and bring attention to what was going on there. And I thought that might be, you know, making a speech or yelling something. But when I walked into the building, they said, are you here for the auction, and would you like to be a bidder? And so I said, Yes, I would. And then the opportunity really just presented itself after that.
Thank you for that. How do you feel about the Obama administration's actions or non-actions, as the case may be, on climate change?
Well, I'd say they've been more disappointing than even the pessimist expected. I think when there has been enough pressure, like with the oil auction system, you know, they have radically changed the way that they lease oil on our public lands. But in general, they've shown that they're not only cowardly, that the Obama administration is not only cowardly, but they're not on our side. Within a year, the Obama administration had the worst coal mining disaster in a generation with the Big Branch mining disaster that killed 29 people in West Virginia. Then they had the worst oil disaster ever in the Gulf, and then they had the worst nuclear disaster in a generation with Fukushima. And that created, you know, the biggest disasters in our big three energy sources. They were all very public. And they had more political will to create a radical change in our energy system than anyone before them has ever had. And they didn't do it. They continue to promote more of the same. And it's not that they don't have the opportunity to do something radically different. The political will from the American people is there. And in my opinion, the Obama administration is actually fighting that off to protect the fossil fuel industry. It couldn't be much worse in terms of the Obama administration continuing the status quo while at the same time deflating progressive movements for change.
Do you think there's any hope or any way to turn that around?
Yes, absolutely. We never should have expected that the Obama administration would be on our side. That's not their job. Obama didn't promote himself as, the leader of our movement. He promoted himself as a politician that was going to respond to the winds of political pressure. And it hasn't been there to a large extent. What I told the youth climate activists at PowerShift, was that if we forced Barack Obama into a choice between, say, ending mountaintop removal or bringing in federal troops to defend mountaintop removal sites against thousands of activists that were pouring onto those sites every day, I don't think he would bring in the troops. I think he would end mountaintop removal before he does that. But it's our responsibility to force him into that choice. If our political leaders actually stood up to the fossil fuel industry, shit would hit the fan. The fossil fuel industry would throw a fit, and they would create a massive amount of chaos and social tension in response to that. If we actually got serious about responding to climate change and moving away from fossil fuels. And so if we want our political leaders to go down that road, the other road has to be even scarier. There has to be even more social tension, even more upheaval by not going down that road than by going down it. That's our job as a movement. That's what other movements before us have realized in actually being successful. That's what groups like the Freedom Riders understood, that they had to create this social crisis that was not going away, and it was escalating and continually getting worse, and forcing their leaders to choose a side between either openly waging war against those activists or ending the war against human beings, which was segregation. And I think we're in a similar position now. We have to force our political leaders into openly waging war against the youth or ending that war against the youth, which is continuing the status quo. That's the choice that we have to force them into.
Sorry. Thank you. Thank you very much for that really interesting spin on socio-political environment. Could you, in that context then, talk about peaceful uprising and the sorts of bold actions you have in mind for your peers? And what is a citizen candidate, citizen's candidate?
Well, Peaceful Uprising is an organization that has grown to try to empower that level of action that's necessary to create that social crisis, to empower people to invite that reaction upon themselves with acts of civil disobedience. And so we try to address a lot of the obstacles that are holding people back from that empowerment. So in our local area in Salt Lake City, we've seen that a lot of that lack of empowerment is due to this kind of isolation and hyper individualism that we have in our society, where people feel like they're just one little person. And so, you know, how is their action going to be important? And so we found that building community and helping people to see that they're not an isolated individual, but they are connected to something much larger than themselves that can be powerful enough to stand up to these huge institutions. That's a lot of what we've been doing here. And also helping folks around the country to have that level of empowerment. That's part of why our emphasis on singing has emerged, in that we saw that's something that reminds people that they're part of something much bigger than themselves when they're singing with hundreds of other people in the street, that it's this very tangible and physical connection to something bigger than themselves. And so that's a lot of what we try to promote, so that people will take those actions of doing things like occupying the Department of the Interior, which 21 folks got arrested for right after the PowerShift conference. Several of them were some of our Utah folks with Peaceful Uprising. But where we're trying to take the movement, I think, is to a point where we stop just making statements with these kind of one-time actions that last for a few hours and then we go back to our normal lives. But we get to a point where, as a movement, we can actually take a stand and say, this is when it starts, and it doesn't end until something changes. It doesn't end until either, you imprison everyone with a conscience or you change the status quo. And that's why we're looking at targets like mountaintop removal in West Virginia, with waves of people walking onto those sites every day, day after day, with no end in sight, forcing those in power to actually pick a side and come down on one side or the other. So that's a lot of what we're driving for now.
Thank you. So in the context of mountaintop removal protests, are you working with Antrim Kasky, who is also a guest at Mountain Film?
With who?
Her name is Antrim Kasky. She's a photographer who has been deeply active with mountaintop removal issue in West Virginia.
No, I don't know the name. We've been working with a group in West Virginia known as RAMPS. That's the Radical Action for Mountain People Survival. They're a group that has been doing a lot of direct actions over the past couple of years, in conjunction with a group called Climate Ground Zero that recently broke up at the beginning of this year. And now RAMPS has become the first Peaceful Uprising chapter. So they're the West Virginia chapter. We're also working with Coal River Mountain Watch and Appalachia Rising, Keepers of the Mountain, Mountain Justice, a lot of others out there. We're certainly not the point for people on that. I think the role of Peaceful Uprising in that sort of thing is that empowerment level, showing folks that there are enough people on our side that we can win this, reminding people that we have that power to not just make a statement about this, but to take a stand, and just getting the momentum rolling on that, because there's lots of activists on the ground that are fighting on the front lines, And I think just giving them the support they need to win is what groups like Peaceful Uprising can bring to the table.
One of those people, I believe, is Alec Lortz, the teen activist. What is your relationship with Alec and his group? How do you help him? He will also be a guest in Mountain Film, as you know.
Yes, and I think Alex and I are doing an event together on Friday at the symposium.
The breakout session of the symposium, you and he are on the same program about youth activism.
Yes. Yes. And Alex is a really amazing figure. He's only 16 years old and has been at this for several years, working with a group called Kids Versus Global Warming that he started. I met him a few years ago at Mountain Film when he was 13 or 14, and now it's really been amazing to see him mature and not only grow about 2 feet taller and a foot taller than me, but also develop a real genuine power of his own and accept that role that he has as what I would call the moral voice of the movement. As a young person, I think he has accepted his role of approaching the ethical nature of this and saying, you know, and making it personal, saying, you know, it's about my future and, you know, it's not just about profit, but it's about my life and making that very personal and about the moral implications of that. And, you know, I think that's the root of the stuff that he's been doing recently with the I Matter marches, you know, getting that across that it's about me and my future matters, and bringing that ethical discussion to the table, which a lot of older activists shy away from, and they shy away from the ethical nature of it and just want to talk about, you know, economics or political feasibility and that sort of thing. So I think he plays a really important role, and I've just tried to, you know, encourage him to whatever extent I could in that.
Thank you for that one. Let's circle back to your case. Your sentencing, I believe, is coming up on June 23rd.
Yes.
And you famously have turned down plea bargaining. Why did you do that?
Well, I've kind of been learning the political system from the inside out as I've been traveling, or the legal system, rather, as I've been traveling through it. And one of the things that I saw is that there's been this trend for a long time in the evolution of our legal system to disempower juries and to concentrate power in the hands of judges and prosecutors. And one of the big ways that they do that is by discouraging people from taking their cases to juries, and making it very well known that the defendants will be punished for taking their case to a jury trial. They'll be punished with a stronger sentence, and seeing that was one of the first things that that influenced me in refusing to go down that path of a plea bargain and insisting that my fellow citizens had an important role to play in our legal process, and that they should be that conscience of the community. They should play that important role as a jury. And I also saw that particularly in cases of political dissidents and in civil disobedience cases, prosecutors always push very strongly for a plea bargain, and I think that's related to the nature of civil disobedience, where an act of civil disobedience is inherently a citizen saying that their government is not the sole moral authority on what constitutes right and wrong, and that regardless of what the law says, that citizen is going to operate out of a higher sense of justice, and operate on a higher moral code. And I think that's an inherent threat to a concentration of power in the hands of government. It's this little it's this little hint that, that undermines that authority and says that there might be something more important than the laws that our government is writing. And I think to regain that authority, they need the activists then to come before the court and say that they were wrong and you know, show fear towards the court and throw themselves at the mercy of the court so that the government can kind of regain that authority. And I had no intention of doing that. I think that to some degree undermines the action. And that's part of why I insisted on taking my case to trial.
Thank you for that. Now, can you talk about meeting George and Beth Gage, and why did you decide to trust them? I'm sure there were a lot of other options. Why did you decide to trust them to express your outrage and your hopes?
Yeah, I met them at the Wild and Scenic Film Festival in early 2009, pretty much about less than a month after the BLM auction. And there were several filmmakers that I had talked to there. And that was when the Gages had finished up their film American Outrage about Mary and Carrie Dan, the Shoshone sisters in Nevada, who were being forced off their land by the BLM and Barrick Mining Company. And Carrie Dan was there, and I got to spend some time with her. And she's this old woman that's been, you know, fighting to stay on her land for decades. And I saw that she was a very strong-headed person, and that clearly no one made her do anything she didn't want to do. No one, you know, could twist her story and present her as anything other than what she really was. And so I figured if the Gages could work with somebody like that, and she still respected them at the end of it, that I could work with them as well, and that is, you know, the way that it's worked out. That is what I've seen, that they have respected my authenticity and not tried to distort it into anything other than who I am.
Okay, wonderful. And why do you keep returning to Mountain Film and Telluride? I believe this is your third. I think it's your third year.
Yes.
What is it that draws you back again and again?
Well, the film's still not finished. we've had a slightly updated version of the film each year, and the story's still not over. It's been a lot slower developing than I expected. But it's also been a really powerful experience for me each year that I've been there, and it always seems to bring together a lot of really powerful people. And there's been some big things that have actually developed for me out of Mountain Film. You know, the first year that I was there was when I really developed my relationship with the Yes Men, and that's led to a lot of activism with that I've done in conjunction with them and different events that I've done with them since then. You know, Mountain Film is where I met people like Chris Jordan that have deeply influenced my thinking. And I always seem to have some powerful experiences there. I'll certainly come back as long as they keep inviting me.
Okay, I'm sure that will be multiple times because your story probably is a work in process for years to come yet. This has been Susan V. Brock, Telluride Inside Now. I've been delighted to be speaking with Tim DeChristopher. He's returning to the 33rd Annual Mountain Film and Telluride over Memorial Weekend for now the third time in a row. He will be part of a Q&A session following another screening of the film about his protest, Bitter 70, George and Beth Gage. He'll be speaking with Terry Tempest Williams and Bill McKibben, and in a breakout session of the symposium on Friday about youth activism. Check Mountain Film's new website for details. Tim, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.